store, you get an extra raffle chance for free.
Enter at kboo.fm/give, or you can buy tickets in person at Music Millennium or Grendel's Coffee.
Deadline to enter is July 7th. See kboo.fm/summer music raffle for full rules and details.
Enter now for your chance to win.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 2019 Juneteenth celebration on Saturday, June 22nd from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the Clark College Hanna Hall in Vancouver, Washington. The theme of the 7th annual Juneteenth celebration is Together We Rise. This theme addresses the idea that together we rise above the fray of hatred, despair, and discord. The celebration features a job fair, panels, awards, contests, an art gallery, live entertainment, and more. Again, that's the 2019 Juneteenth celebration on Saturday, June 22nd from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the Clark College Hanna Hall, 1933 Fort Vancouver Way in Vancouver, Washington. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning, you're tuned into Pacific Underground. I'm your host, Sarah Onitska, and on today's show, we're going to be talking about a recent bit of disturbing and disheartening news, that the Trump administration has made the decision to use the Fort Sill base in Oklahoma as a site to incarcerate migrant children. So not only is that terrible news in and of itself, but this site historically has been used to incarcerate and enact violence on Japanese Americans and indigenous folks. So as a fourth-generation Japanese-American, today I wanted to get together with some fellow Nikkeis and talk about what this means, how history continues to repeat itself, and what we can do as a community. So I'm joined today by Chisao Hata. Hi, Chisao.
Hi, Sarah.
And Jenna Yokoyama will be joining us shortly. So the first question I guess I wanted to get started with to give folks some context for those who are listening is, Chisao, what generation are you? And what's your relationship to these camps?
I'm a third generation Japanese American, or Sansei. Mm-hmm. And I was born and raised in Des Moines, Iowa, in the Midwest, as a direct result of my parents being incarcerated in the Poston, Arizona camp.
Okay.
And so they were married in Poston,
wow.
Arizona. And I have since, I don't know when exactly, I guess the later 70s, been involved in education and working for redress, and continue to tell the stories of Japanese Americans in our history, which involves a major part of that as being in the concentration camps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I am a Yonsei, so fourth generation. Three of my grandparents were in the camps. So my grandfather on my dad's side, I believe, was at Poston. My grandmother on my dad's side was at Apache, Granada. And then my grandfather on my mom's side was incarcerated at Tule Lake. I feel like I've, you know, I'm pretty young still, I'm 23, but I'm sort of growing into this identity and realizing how important it is for me, even as a younger generation person, to be speaking out about what's happening now. So
I'm just reflecting on 20 years from now, what will the story of these children be?
Right, and that's terrifying to consider. So when you heard this news, you know, about Fort Sill being used to detain children, how did it make you feel? What was your reaction to it?
Well, I think that my first reaction was physical, in that you kind of feel like you get punched in the stomach, and you want to cry, but as we're coming to call tomorrow's action that's in support of the Fort Sill action in Oklahoma mm-hmm. tomorrow, I feel like, you know, when I look at the history of Fort Sill and the history of racism in America and how people of color have been affected, I feel like there's almost no more tears. Like, how many tears must we cry?
Right.
And, you know, tears of anger, tears mm-hmm. of pain, tears of loss. There's so many different ways that we have cried that
right.
it's calling for beyond that. And, like, enough is enough, and right. never again is now.
It's taking those tears and that anger and putting them to action, right?
Yes.
So just so not stopping there, and I guess, you know, sitting in that grief and anger. Jenna has now joined us. Hi, Jenna.
Howdy.
Hi, Jenna.
Jenna, could you tell us a little bit about yourself? Maybe what generation, and sort of similar to what I asked Chisao just a couple of minutes ago?
Yeah, so I am, like Sarah, that I am a fourth generation Japanese American. So that means that my grandparents and my great grandparents were put into concentration camps during World War II. And, okay, what was the question? I'm sorry.
Generation and what your connection is to these camps and I guess to this history and legacy.
So my family doesn't have a direct history to Fort Sill, but I definitely had many children in my family being incarcerated, and it's so painful to know that, you know, one thing, it was injustice to take away the adults, but to take away the children who literally did nothing, and then to treat them like prisoners is, it's just, I don't even know how to describe how painful it is. Like, it's angering, but more than anything, it's just painful, because I do see that the government tries to push this message about Japanese Americans that, like, everything in camp was fine. It was fine. They were treated so well. Look, they were fed meals, and we gave them shelter, and things were fine, and that the children were, you know, they always love to push these pictures of the children doing, like, the Pledge of Allegiance, and
right.
they had Girl Scouts and things like that. And it's just such an illusion that they're using Japanese Americans to create this imagery of, say, like, look what we've been doing 75 years ago. It was fine. And they're pushing that same message. But then, you know, we see in the news today that they weren't, like, given toothbrushes and mm-hmm. soap. And that, to me, just, like, it just, I just shook my head. It was just so angry, because that's exactly what happened to Japanese Americans. It's
yeah.
like nothing is changing, right? When Japanese Americans were told to go to camp, as we call it, quote unquote camp, which were incarceration camps, concentration camps, they were told to bring their own toothbrush. You know, they're told to bring their own, like, literally, like, bring a plate so you can eat on something. So you're literally having to pay for your own incarceration on top of it. You know, it's the idea that you should be providing basic, simple, like, human rights and human dignity is not something that our government seems to be very concerned with, like, two generations later. So I don't really know what's changing.
Yeah. Did you see the tweets by ICE recently where
no.
they were connecting Pride Month to, they were saying, you know, oh, we treat the folks essentially being held in our centers with dignity and respect, and they had all these photos
oh
of people
God.
Reading Bibles and, like, doing all of these activities.
Oh,
yeah. Right. So they're pushing that same narrative and that same message
in the same way,
that same propaganda
yeah.
over and over.
Propaganda is what it
yeah.
is. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we were spies.
Yeah.
That's how they justified, you know,
mm-hmm.
taking 120,000 Japanese and Japanese Americans from the West Coast because of the potential danger and because of the military necessity. And I don't know. I think part of the narrative is they're degenerates.
Yeah.
Now. You mean?
Now.
Yeah.
They're
mm-hmm.
degenerates, and we have to protect our country from, I don't know what, an invasion, but I think
an
what's...
invasion of children.
Yeah. but what's at stake is our humanity.
Yeah.
The larger issue is, how do we as human beings care for each other beyond borders or beyond cultures, or just what is our basic humanity towards mm-hmm. each other? And this is not what we should be looking at as a legacy.
Right. There's also been a discussion recently, since this news came out, and then a couple of articles soon after, about the term concentration camp, and how we should be applying it to these detention centers that migrants and folks seeking asylum are currently being held in. What do you guys think about that?
Well, I think that language is a very tricky thing and will try to trick you. You know, the concentration camps that were the 10 major camps during World War II were just that. When you think of 10,000 people located in a desert in over 100 degrees in the summer and below 20 degrees in the winter, I mean, just how you survive that kind of environment. And then, you know, now it's just the titles of them are tricky. It's to get us off track of what is actually happening.
They're euphemisms, happening. Right?
They're prisons.
Yeah.
You know, you can call them many, many different names, but they're military prisons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, something that I always seem to have to educate people on, because the government has been so good at creating these euphemisms around Japanese-American experience, where, you know, even Japanese-Americans tend to call the camps internment camps, which actually have a very specific legal definition, which is about, quote-unquote, enemy aliens, right? Roosevelt himself, who created the camps, or for Japanese-Americans at least, you know, called them concentration camps, and that's what the government was calling, because that's what they were. It was a concentration, putting a concentration of civilians who hadn't actually legally done anything wrong into a concentrated location, right? So, you know, I understand the emotions that it brings up for people when they say, like, well, are you taking away from the experience of what the Holocaust was? And, I mean, this has been a long discussion between the Japanese-American community and the Jewish community, and it's a very difficult one, because we don't want to take away from the horrors of what that experience was, and definitely that term concentration camp took on a much different understanding in the public's mind after World War II because of what the Jewish, you know, community and people went through. So I think it's a fair discussion to say, like, yes, now we have a kind of different understanding of culturally and around the world how we use that term, but that we also need to talk about how the government has then used that to create the euphemism and say, oh, well, no, that's what the Nazis did, and they want to try to disassociate this idea of, like, putting people in camps, civilians in camps, as, oh, it's okay. It's, yeah, so it's, as Chisao, I think I agree with what Chisao says, like, it's like language is tricky. And the main thing to take away from it is to understand the legal nuances of the terms, so that we can understand, like, the scope of what the government is doing. Right, because they're going to want to call them detention centers. Mm-hmm,
or holding centers.
We're detaining.
Yeah, and even I think the term concentration camp used for the Nazi camps was somewhat of a euphemism as well. Right.
They were
death camps.
Yeah.
So I think we need to be changing all of our language. And I mean it's really, like you said, changing the language to change our understanding of really what the reality of the situation in those places.
And also to understand what the danger of concentration camps are, right? Because that's how it started in Germany. They didn't start off as death camps. Mm-hmm. You know, it was like, but once you put a similar people into a confined location, right, then it becomes easier to dehumanize them and to just look at them as the enemy, because you're putting them all in the same place, you're dehumanizing them, then you can push this propaganda, right? And so it's dangerous. Yeah. It's so dangerous of what these things lead to. So I think that's what people need to keep in mind.
Yeah. It is an American issue, but it's also a global issue, because how are we as humans treating each other on the planet? And so it's not just about the racism in America, which, you know, I feel like we have to focus on, but it's based in fear. And when the actions are based in fear, it doesn't bring out the best of humanity. It brings out how are we going to survive? How are we going to survive against this invasion or against this, you know, whatever it's perceived to be? So I think that people of color have a lot more power and kind of historical knowledge to lead the country, to lead America. And it should not be a question of what is lost. We should be talking, we should be having the dialogue about what is gained. There's nothing to lose. They're not degenerates. We're not spies. We're not whatever the terminology is used based in fear. But what do we have to gain if we all are part of this American experiment?
Right. Yeah, so if you're just now tuning in, you're listening to Pacific Underground here on KBOO Community Radio. I'm your host, Sarah Onitska, and we're talking with Japanese Americans, Jenna and Chisao. So I think, you know, I really also want to talk about, to shift this conversation towards how this site, Fort Sill, has been used to enact violence on other communities in the past as well. So I know that there was a Native American boarding school on that site. It also
quote-unquote boarding school.
Yeah, which is another euphemism. Yeah. It served as a prisoner of war camp as well for Chiricahua Apache tribe members. And actually the leader of the tribe, Geronimo, died there in 1909. So, I mean, right, guys? I mean,
that's
these
so painful.
These lands for centuries have been used to hurt people.
Not originally.
Right.
We were dispossessed.
Right.
Native Americans were dispossessed of their land.
Mm-hmm.
And so what has happened since then is a false ownership.
Mm-hmm.
Or I don't know if ownership is the right terminology, but taking, taking.
Like occupying.
Yeah.
Colonizing.
Yeah, colonizing the land. And so that history is toxic. It's like putting, you know, garbage upon garbage and more toxicity.
The trauma builds.
And the racism in America is what is being shown here. It's not just one community. It's not just the Native American community, but it sort of exemplifies what racism in America has looked like since before the Civil War.
I feel like Fort Sill is very much, like you're saying, it's our American legacy, right? Like, once you create the idea, you know, it's just going to continue because you've set up the infrastructure and it's easy to allow it to continue. And, you know, one thing that also I think people find kind of shocking about this story is that it people want to, like, blame the current administration for what's happening. But the Obama administration used Fort Sill as a detention center for migrants in just, what was that, 2014?
2014.
You know, and I remember that. I remember them talking about that at the time. And I remember that being just so disappointing but not shocking. Well, it's like, of course, because it's the entire governmental system that sees the infrastructure and they use all these euphemisms with themselves. So they say, oh, well, we just, here's a camp that's already established. The infrastructure's already there. We put these people to hold them. I hate when they say that.
Hold
them. You're not holding them. You're like holding them at gunpoint. That's it's one of those euphemisms always.
Imprisoning them.
Yeah.
I mean,
and we're talking about a lot of children. Yeah. We're not talking about 100.
I think they
there
said
were 700 Japanese and Japanese Americans who were detained, so-called detained, and held at Fort Sill. Now they're talking about double that number.
Say 1,400.
1,400 children. And I want people to think about, if you do have children, if your child, suddenly you're in the store and they run away and they're lost, the fear and the panic that you have at that moment, what if it never went away? Mm-hmm. That's what's happening. you're losing your child. Your child is losing their parents. And that kind of trauma, you can't take it back. It's going to have an effect, whether they're here in America or wherever they are, mm-hmm. on their entire lives. And even, as we know, in the lives of generations and their ancestors mm-hmm. to come. It's not just the children right now. So we know that as Japanese Americans. We have that, even though you were not directly affected,
right.
your relatives, your ancestors were in the camps.
Yeah.
And we talked about that is in our cells.
Mm-hmm.
That is in our blood. That right. is in our knowing. That is that trauma and that shame is passed on.
Yeah, I call it fire in my veins. So my grandfather was, on my mom's side, was incarcerated at Tule Lake. And Tule Lake was historically known as the segregation camp where the dissidents were sent to after the first year. So essentially, you know, everybody who they deemed unloyal. And so he was there for 4+ years. And we don't know a ton about it because, you know, he's since passed away and he never talked about it ever. But just kind of that history and knowing that, yes, intergenerational trauma transfers, you know, generation to generation, but so does the resilience and so does the rage. Like, I feel it so deeply within myself. And I'm sure mm-hmm. it's the same for you all, too.
Mm-hmm. Fire in my veins. Keep mm-hmm. that, Sarah. I think that might make a good tattoo. Yeah. Ooh.
Actually, it really, wow. That is a good idea.
And yeah. I'm not a tattoo person.
Yeah, I would love to get I would love to get that tattoo.
Fire in my veins.
Well, because, you know, it's so important to, like, in a tattoo, I can totally understand because I have a tattoo that is very much representative of that for me, too, because part of the narrative that the government pushed on the Japanese Americans and that we've helped to perpetuate their terrible message in many ways is, you know, that we need to have this attitude of everything is fine, everything is okay, just forget about it, forget about it, forget about it. And unfortunately, a lot of people in our community have. But I think we all feel the fire, but we are like, oh, wait, no, that's a bad feeling. I need to suppress it, you know? So, I mean, I got a tattoo that takes up half my back. Because I was just like, no, we will remember the rage. And but it's not to be angry, but just to remember that, like, the feelings I feel and the experiences I have are valid. And to remember that, you know, we have this government that constantly comes in and just tells us, like, forget, forget, forget. And they need us to forget. They need Japanese Americans to forget so that they can continue what they're doing mm-hmm. and have no historical knowledge to say, like, hey, isn't this just history repeating? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that idea. So I'm gonna make a tattoo appointment right away.
Uh-oh, and I don't even believe in tattoos. I couldn't do it.
Don't worry, Chisa, you got the fire.
Yeah,
you got the fire.
No, you don't need it physically represented on your body.
You're like a dragon. You could, like, go up to Sarah, be like, stick out your arm, and then the tattoo, be like, and the tattoo yeah. would appear and be like, I bequeath this to you.
You know, in my anti-nuclear work, one of the actions that I was so inspired by is the kind of action that creates the world you want to see. So, for instance, you know, in some of the nuclear sites, just going on the site and having a picnic yeah. because it should be available to everyone, that land, that greenery, to have a picnic. But instead it's, you know, barbed off and you can't get access. And so to me, that was a powerful action. So I'm wondering, like, if we could envision, because as an artist, I'm always trying to think of that. What is the creative, not to deny the hate and the rage and the fire, but, you know, these children are not given basic needs. And beyond that, education, or, you know, when we were incarcerated, people automatically organized. They had the ability to do that, to organize. And if they hadn't have done that, I don't know what that experience would have been for our, you know, ancestors. But because they're separated from their families, they don't have that ability to organize. And then they don't have resources to, you know, basic education or, you know, language or games or, I mean, just how do you survive? You can't just sit in one spot day in and day out.
We've already heard about how many children have already died in Kusi. It's horrific.
Yeah. And so what would those forts look like if they were turned around into something creative? I mean, I know it's like a kind of pie in the sky kind of idea, but...
Well, I mean, doesn't that remind me of like... last time I went down to where my family was put into the concentration camp at Manzanar in California, most of the site is no longer there. You know, it used to have, I don't even know how many barracks, but most of the barracks have been pulled down and they just have like a few things that have remained. And it's basically become a museum. And I really like appreciate that the museum is there because it teaches the history, but it's just like that too, like how do we just tear down these sites so they cannot be used again? You turn them into a museum rather than just a holding infrastructure facility that's just sitting there waiting for the next group to come
through. Used again.
Yeah. And you know, and it was an empowering thing for me to go to Manzanar and like see my family's name up there, but just like to remember that, like, oh yes, it's very important that this was torn down and that it wasn't disappeared, because that's a lot of the sites from the concentration camps left over from World War II. It's like, well, let's just get rid of them and let's act like it didn't happen. And then they can rebuild in the same way. It's like, no, we need to get rid of this, but also remember. But I don't know how much remembering at this point. I mean, it's just when I see the history of how children get treated by the American government from the colonizing founding, it's, you know, here in Portland, we have even that story where, children, when they were all being taken over to the assembly center, because that's how people got put into the concentration camps. First, you were taken to an assembly center, quote unquote assembly center. The children were pulled from school and put on buses without their parents, right? And then taken to the assembly center, because, you know, if you put the kids first, well, then the parents will follow. You know, it's always using children in like the most inhumane way to create trauma, to create panic. And it's so calculated. It's so systemic, you know?
I think as long as the racism in America is based in capitalism, someone gains something by others suffering.
Yeah.
So, you know, how can we turn that around when you have the highest rate of incarceration ever in this country, mm-hmm. to equal the number of that were, you know, enslaved? There's something wrong with the privatization of prisons, and I think it's also connected with the military, the bases. You know, it's just someone is making money, and the more people suffer and other people make money off of that suffering, something is really wrong. That's what's questioning our humanity.
Well, I mean, isn't that always what journalism question number one or the step is follow the money? Like, no matter what the topic is, no matter what you're investigating, follow the money. And it always works. It always works. And, you know, so I wonder this about Fort Sill too. Like, who's making money off this? Someone's making money. There's never an instance where someone isn't making money, so...
Well, I think some of the organizations that are involved in the privatization of prisons are benefiting. And, you know, our government spends a lot of money, and it comes in from different directions. So there's a military direction, there's a customs direction, there's the immigration direction. There's money being spent, and money's being appropriated to uphold these organizations and increase our prison system. I have to kind of put those two things together in my mind, because I think that they're connected. You know, how we target communities of color.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think one other thing I just wanted to mention about Fort Sill was that, you know, the conditions were so bad there that there was actually a man. His name was Kensaburo Oshima, and he was essentially, you know, driven to a mental breakdown and he tried to escape the camps and was, you know, shot and brutally killed before he could escape. So it's like, it's thinking about, you know, not making, I just wanted to bring mm-hmm. that up because I didn't want that part to be forgotten yeah. or erased, mm-hmm. To make sure to say his name in this moment and remember just the history and how much pain and trauma these lands have mm-hmm. carried for so many communities.
And again, those officers were, you know, deemed justified.
Right. They were just doing their job.
In their action, which is no different than the police, you know, in the African American communities. And one article that I read cited that to date, 7 known migrant children have died. And while that doesn't seem like many, there is also 7 Japanese Americans who were killed from the ages mm-hmm. of 17 through, I think, 60, 65 or so. Mm-hmm. And so that analogy was being made in an article that I read, that 7-7.
I can't even imagine being the families of those children and learning that news that your child had died away from you and at the hands of a government when that child was just trying to escape violence. It's
when you're trying to protect your child.
Yeah. It's I can't even imagine. I don't want to.
Yeah. So I think we're going to take a quick break here. We're going to play a song called Directions by Nako and Medicine for the People.
For the west, for the north, for the east, for the south,
Hi, so if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Pacific Underground here on KBOO Community Radio. I'm your host, Sarah Onitsuka, and we're talking with Portland-based Japanese-Americans Jenna Yokoyama and Chisao Hata about the Trump administration's decision to incarcerate migrant children at the Fort Sill base in Oklahoma, where historically other marginalized groups, including Japanese-Americans, were incarcerated. So the song you just heard was Directions by Nako and Medicine for the People. Nako is actually a mixed Apache, Puerto Rican, and Filipino artist. And I feel like, I mean, not only were, you know, Apache folks actually incarcerated at this site in the past, but also the song lyrics, which, if it's okay, that I just read real quickly, really resonated with me. So the lyrics said, "For the West, for the North, for the East, for the South. Grandfather, I'm calling on you. Need your guidance now. Grandmother, I'm calling on you. Need your guidance now." And I felt that was just so powerful and relevant to our own story as well, because as Japanese Americans, right, our ancestors and our elders are so important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's painful. I just keep using that word. It's painful to literally listen to those words. Yeah, just because it's a feeling of helplessness, I guess, in myself. I hate to be making about me, but I guess my feelings and just hearing the words are just like, you can call upon the ancestors, try as hard as you can to call upon the ancestors, but sometimes this beast that we're up against feels so monumental that sometimes I wonder if our cries get heard. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But then you realize, I guess as Japanese Americans, I sort of feel like, okay, the way we call upon those ancestors is to constantly repeat the story that they weren't allowed to. And like that's that fire, the tattoo we all need to get, that's what that is, right? It's like,
break,
I'm like, oh,
down.
Yeah, that's their calling, is like, I wasn't allowed to show the fire, so I gave it to you. And now it's your job to just constantly not stop talking. Just keep telling everybody the story, because, you know, it's the only way to stop things is to constantly humanize people. I don't know why we can't just humanize people by looking at someone going, oh, I'm a human, you're a human, oh, we're all humans. But yeah. Oh, Chisao, we have a story. Would you mind sharing that?
Well, I think it's a role. I want to just say it's a role of an artist.
Yeah,
to help in these ways. And I think that's where Nako has brought his music to Native American movements and movement work. And his music has been out there for many, many years and is important because of his background and his understanding, the four directions, the wisdom of the lyrics. And we had, you know, I'd mentioned Nobuko. We had Nobuko Miyamoto, who was really our voice of the time of Asian American movement. And so the voices are still there, the voices are changing. And I think that as artists, it's very important to continue to look at the creative aspects of how we share pain. And that we share it in a way that other people can cross over from theirs into ours, and then it becomes a shared human experience. So that's part of what we were doing when we created Gambate, an American Legacy, which was a play that we just did. Jenna was part of that creative ensemble, and you know, sharing our emotional legacies. So it is about trauma, but it's also about resilience. It's also about our food. It's also about our culture. And when you think about the ancestors, what I want to say is we have 120,000 ancestors times how many. Each of those had families and ancestors, and so it could be easily over 1 million, 2 million people. So those are the people that are behind you. Those are the people that are, you know, blowing at your neck to continue to light the fire, to continue to do the work. So you're never alone. Tell the story.
So in Gambate, the play that Chisao and I recently produced with the Vanport Mosaic Festival, so just a couple weeks ago, we tried to create an artistic work that wasn't so much out to give people facts, because there's a lot of plays and books that tell the factual part of the Japanese American experience. Came here on this date, we went to camp, and then on this date, this happened, on this date, that happened. But what there isn't always a lot of discussion of is about the emotional legacy that that left people with, the good and the bad. And so we tried to create a piece that humanized the Japanese American experience and tried to show people how it felt to come, you know, to America, have this hopeful idea, then to be put into these camps because of the way you look, and then what is, you know, the fallout from that, the emotional fallout from that. And we had quite an emotional reaction to our play from people. We weren't sure how it was going to be received, but we found that, you know, there was people who had been to who had been imprisoned in the concentration camp, finally, like, watching the play, and then if affecting them so much that they finally told their stories to their family. And but one of the stories that came out of it was somebody who was someone you might not expect to go see that play, somebody who had voted for Trump, and saw the play, and they said that now they find, what was it exactly what they said? I want to get the words wrong, Chisa. They said that they finally understand.
They didn't say it to me. So.
Oh, what was it? What the, you heard the story of 30.
Okay, well, you told it better than me.
Was it that they finally understood?
Yeah, they crossed over their personal narrative into this one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was like, yay, we all sort of felt like, oh, yes, we finally, we reached out to them, because that's who you really want to try to talk to, are the people who don't understand the human element, and that they're finally getting it, that all these people you're imprisoning and killing are people with real lives, you know. But at the same time, you just want to slam your head into the table and say, oh my God, is this the work? Do I have to produce an entire play to convince one person that we're human beings? Oh my gosh, this is going to be a long process, you know, but it literally feels that way. And that's why we see things happening over and over again, because you have to humanize people to individuals that have the power, that have the influence and the privilege.
Yeah, and I mean, that's so hard and terrible too, because I feel like it shouldn't be our responsibility, you know, to do that, to say, hey, you know, look at us, we're people. And it's just, yeah, it's just such slow work too, educating people. But yeah, I went and saw Gambate as well, and I just absolutely loved it. I went with my mom, and her father was the one who was incarcerated at Tule Lake, and he died before we could ask him about it, you know, which is kind of a similar story to a lot of Japanese Americans, younger generations. But it was, I mean, it was so strange, because he ended up serving in the Korean War right after he was, you know, released from incarceration, and so when he got older and like ended up developing dementia, he would talk and just like kind of rant really about his times in the war. So we heard a ton about that. He showed us pictures, he had albums, you know. But he still did not ever talk about camp and being incarcerated. And so I just think, wow, looking back on it, I mean, that must have been buried so, so deep down, to the point where even if he was, you know, kind of, he was ill and kind of like, losing a sense of himself in a lot of ways, like that still did not bubble to the surface.
Yeah. I mean, so. Just shows how much trauma, I mean, it's a many, many levels, right? Like people are going through massive amounts of trauma, so they have to bury it. Plus, they were also taught to be ashamed of what happened, mm-hmm. that you were Absolutely. To blame, right? And that's like the huge narrative that's constantly getting pushed right now, which blows my mind and doesn't, because it's been centuries of the American government saying this, that the children are to blame for their own incarceration. If they just hadn't been like this, and if they just hadn't done this, if they just hadn't done that. I just am not sure what asylum is for, why we even have that concept in this country, yeah. if when people seek it, we treat them like prisoners, you know? It's
because they're, I mean, legally, they are allowed to come here yeah. and seek asylum and not be detained while they're waiting to hear what the decision is. Yeah. So,
yeah.
A big sigh. But I guess, I don't know. I think it's important to shift to, as Chisao was saying earlier, from this grief and rage into, you know, what can we productively do? Like, what are our next steps?
Creative action, because what happens, and we've seen it happen over and over again with activism, is activists get burned out.
Yeah.
Because it's always raging against. And so that's why I feel like the role of the artist is so important. This action that is happening tomorrow in conjunction with the Fort Sill action in Oklahoma tomorrow is why we're here and why we're talking about this particular issue. But people have been activated since Dilley, Texas, which mm-hmm. was near the Crystal City.
They had an on-site protest there, right in March. Right.
Yeah. And it's been happening even before that. So Fort Sill is another example of the, use of federal lands mm-hmm. to once again imprison people of color. And so because that action is happening tomorrow, we will be at the Japanese American Plaza, Historical Plaza, from 11 to 12 mm-hmm. tomorrow, in protest and support and solidarity. And we are calling our event No More Tears. And I feel that never again is now. Yeah. Because we would say, you know, never again should anyone be imprisoned in the kind of situation Japanese Americans were in, denied their civil rights. But it's happening again. And so we have to speak up. And I feel like this is maybe the beginning of another movement, of a national movement that will bring people of color together, because there have been many ways that we've been divided or so busy trying to tell our own story and heal our own, you know, effects of racism. But as we collectively come together, Latinx people and Native American people and African American people and Asian Americans, we all come together, we are the majority of tomorrow.
Oh, now we're back.
Now we're back. No, I'm not.
Or at least my mic is back. Here, Chisao, finish your thought into this mic.
So tomorrow at the rally, we will have those communities also represented in the day in the program at the event. So I encourage everyone to join us tomorrow, that's Saturday, at the Japanese American Historical Plaza, which is located right on downtown. It's kind of known as the area where the cherry blossom trees are.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's the history of the Japanese Americans in Oregon, the wall, the break in the wall, the bronze pillars that represent are being taken away on the trains. So there'll be several things going on there. Oh, okay. So something's happening with the mic. And we want to see as many people in solidarity with us tomorrow from 11 to 12 at the Japanese American Historical Plaza to make a statement to our government, not only to our government, but in support of and in solidarity with the action that's being held at Fort Sill tomorrow.
Yeah, and the one at Fort Sill, I believe, is just, I think it's from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., and they're gathering at the site. It's, I believe, a gathering of Japanese Americans from all across the country.
And certainly the Nisei, who are the children of confinement, these are the people that are still alive,
yeah,
who are in their 80s, and who are stepping out and stepping forward and saying, this is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
We will not allow it. We're going to speak about our, you know, our experience and what happened to us, even though most of them were like 5, 6, 7, and 8 years old. They are the children of confinement, and they're saying, this happened to us. It should not happen again to any other children. And so the Japanese Americans are very clear that this is wrong.
Yeah. I'm definitely wanting to see more of an intergenerational turnout as well. I think there are a lot of Yonseis who are at least sort of starting to realize that, like, this history and this legacy is not lost. And really, I mean, not to go back to this phrase again, but sort of the fire in the veins concept, like, hasn't been diluted throughout the generations. Like, I feel like it's just as strong as where it started. And so I would love to see just, like, more folks activated. Because, I mean, you know, I mean, deep within ourselves, we feel it, and we feel this loss of culture, and like we're missing something, right? And so, I hope, yeah.
It's also getting to know it in a different way, believing that it's in you,
mm-hmm,
because you're not going to get it through the educational system.
That's true.
You may not even get it from your families. And so that doesn't deny the fact that it's there, that it's a part of you, that your history is with you. And you studied, what is it called? Cells? Genetics?
Yeah. Oh, I was a neuroscience major in college. And so, mm-hmm, we talked about the concept of epigenetics.
Epigenetics, yeah. Yep.
Which is, you know, I guess, like, things that happen to somebody in their life. So not just genetics, but actual experiences that people go through can be passed down through generations, and there's real scientific evidence of this now. So we're not just saying this to be, you know, metaphorical or anything, mm-hmm, either.
You know, you said something a little bit earlier about loss of culture, and that is like a huge element. But I feel like sometimes you're like, oh well, it's just culture, whatever. But I think what people need to remember is that it's even a stronger thing in my view. It's that it wasn't a loss of culture, it was a loss of humanity, and that's what,
yeah,
caused the trauma, and that's what causes the fire that I think is like a smoldering flame, is that it wasn't just about like, oh, you took away our language or our food, even though that's huge as a part of humanity, but they literally stripped people of their humanity, and that's the horrific part of the children. It's just like, they're, yes, those things that help connect you to your humanity will hopefully not be lost, but will probably be lost on them. They're going to be traumatized. We've seen the kids who have just been, you know, incarcerated for just a few months, when they get returned to their parents, are just, they're not the same people because they've been stripped of their humanity, right? And that's going to pass on for the rest of their lives, as you're just saying.
They've,
you know,
been denied love.
Yeah, and that's humanity, right?
Mm-hmm.
They need that. I mean, it's just sad.
I want to really encourage anyone out there listening to come tomorrow to the plaza from 11 to 12, that's,
mm-hmm,
Saturday, 11 to 12. Bring your children, bring your young people, bring anyone that needs to know about this history and what is going on today. We need to be there en masse.
Yeah. I remember growing up, my mom was one of the few people in our family who tried to get people to talk about what had happened to our family, and she was big on children must learn, because they're the ones who actually can get the actions done, and they need to have it from a part of their being from the time they're little, right? So it's like, just push this message of like, your kids are never too young to learn about what's happening to other children, because they're the ones also who will give you the perspective of what those children are losing, you mm-hmm. know, besides all their humanity. Can we just say humans? Just
yeah.
If someone else is a human, treat them like a human. Ugh.
There's a lot of work to be done.
And I think for, you know, the Issei and the Nisei and even Sansei generations that, you know, for the sake of the children, making decisions that might protect your child is not a bad thing. But in our case, sometimes that protection denied us of facts.
Yeah, where they wanted to protect them by not telling them what happened.
Right, protect us from the horrific part of history. And it doesn't go away. It won't go away. It'll continue to come back in our lives.
I think, like, the goal for me with the analogy of the fire and the smoldering flames and all stuff is that it would just be so amazing if other generations didn't have to have that. That's the goal. I would love to
one day get to a world where it doesn't have to.
Yeah.
To
exist. Just think of all the creative energy there would be.
Yeah. Well, guys, we're about out of time for today's show, so I wanted to really sincerely thank you both, Jenna and Gisao, for joining me today, for sharing your experiences and your insights into this issue. I mean, it's hard to talk about. It's painful, but we have to keep doing it. And just a final reminder to check out the rally in Portland tomorrow in solidarity with the protest at Fort Sill. It's from 11 to 12 p.m. at the Japanese American Historical Plaza on the waterfront. To hear this interview again or to listen to previous episodes of Pacific Underground, go to KBOO's website at kboo.fm or search for Pacific Underground on iTunes and Google Play. For Pacific Underground and KBOO Community Radio, I'm Sarah Onitska, and thank you so much for listening.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, Hood River and the Gorge at 91.9 FM, Philomath and Corvallis at 104.3 FM, and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
I hate a song that makes you think that you're not any good. I hate a song that makes you think you're just born to lose, bound to lose. No good to nobody, no good for nothing. Because you're either too old or too young or too fat or too thin or too ugly or too this or too that. Songs that run you down or songs that poke fun at you on account of your bad luck or your hard traveling. I am out to fight those kind of songs to my very last breath of air and my last drop of blood. I'm out to sing songs that will prove to you that this is your world and that if it's hit you pretty hard and knocked you down, for a dozen loops, no matter how hard it's run you down and rolled over you, no matter what color, what size you are, how you're built, I am out to sing the songs that'll make you take pride in yourself.